where did I? Tinatata e Tiniwiki o Te Reo Māori. Greetings on this, the Māori Language Week. As you will have seen earlier today, I announced an appointment within the New Zealand intelligence community. The Honourable Andrew McGeachan has been appointed Inspector General of Intelligence and Security. His term starts today. Mr. McGeachan is a former High Court judge and has held a number of other legal, academic and public sector roles. I'd like to thank the outgoing Inspector General, the Honourable Paul Naser, for his work in the role since 2004. Mr. Naser generously continued in the role beyond his term until Mr. McGeachan was able to take up the position. I'm grateful Mr. McGeachan has agreed to move into this important position at a time of great change within the New Zealand intelligence community. He has indicated he sees the role as an interim one, pending likely changes to the role proposed in the legislation currently before the House. The GCSB recently released its first quarterly update on its progress in meeting the recommendations made in Rebecca Kittredge's report. The GCSB is responsible for meeting 76 of the 80 recommendations, and the progress report is available on its website. I'm pleased the organisation is well on its way to implementing the changes recommended by Rebecca Kittredge. Already 25 changes have been completed, and 11 more are on track to be completed next quarter. The changes at the GCSB include appointing key staff like an associate director and a chief legal advisor. It's also established new processes and systems across its legal and compliance frameworks. The GCSB is under no illusion that bringing about change and regaining the public's trust will take some time and effort. Some of the changes the organisation needs to make will take well into next year. But I'm confident the staff are committed to making the changes recommended by Ms. Kitteridge. The next update for the GCSB is scheduled for September. Today I'm also announcing that we are releasing criteria for the applications for funds for the Tourism Grant Growth Partnership, a new government initiative aimed at boosting innovation and lifting productivity in the tourism sector. Under the Tourism Growth Partnership, the government is making $28 million available over 4 years to support innovative projects to create new opportunities and overcome barriers to growth in the tourism sector. The Tourism Growth Partnership is a contestable co-investment program. For each project approved for investment, the government will provide up to 50% of the funding required. In Budget 2013, we invested $158 million in achieving growth in tourism earnings. However, simply attracting more high-spending visitors is in itself not enough. This $28 million, which is part of the $158 million, is being made available so the domestic tourism sector, through its marketing, distribution chains, products and services, can turn increased numbers of tourists into value for business and the New Zealand economy. I encourage the tourism sector to start thinking now about developing proposals for investment, and I look forward to seeing what businesses and tourist providers can achieve through this investment. Just in terms of the House this week, the government intends to make progress on the Psychoactive Substances Bill, State Sector and Public Finance Reform Bill and the Public Finance Bill. And activities this week, just in terms of my activities, I'm in Wellington tomorrow and Wednesday for the usual caucus and House activities. On Thursday I'll have a full day of events in the Tasman electorate, and then on Friday I'll be attending all day Waikato Iwi meetings. Questions?
Minister, on the Christchurch consent issue, what will functionally change from 5 p.m. on Friday to 9 a.m. on Monday when it switches?
Well, firstly, I think it's important to note this move by the accredited body, IANZ, is unprecedented. I don't think there's any other council that's lost its consenting authority. So what is happening on Wednesday is that Minister Brownlee and Tremaine will be travelling to Christchurch to talk to the Christchurch City Council about next steps. Put on the table some proposals to allow progress to continue and to see where we can go next.
How will MB actually step in and help with this process? How will they be involved?
Well, I don't want to spell out everything that they're going to take, you know, with them on Wednesday, but I think what is clear is that we do need to resolve this situation. It's critically important for the rebuild of Christchurch that the process is speeded up. And for all intents and purposes, you know, as of next Friday, or this Friday, the Christchurch City Council will have lost its accreditation authority, so it's very important that we take that step.
Is it concerning to you that the Council couldn't spell out exactly how things will change?
Well, I think in the end now, the real issue is to work on what the next steps are, how we resolve this position, how we make sure that not only they have their accredited status, or at least their authority is contained within the functionality of Christchurch, but also ultimately how we can speed up the process. I mean, I think, if I'm reading it right, IANZ, who removed effectively the accreditation from the Christchurch City Council, didn't say there was a problem with any individual application or application that was approved. Their concern is about the overall processes.
What are the options for the government?
I think they're many and varied, but I mean, it would be better if we had those discussions with the council and see if we can find a way through. Certainly we're keen to try and find a pathway through that would meet with acceptance from the council, but in the end, you know, the government does need to take steps if that can't be resolved.
Do you have the governor rebuild of the city? I mean, does this raise concerns for you about the competence of the Christchurch City Council?
Look, I don't want to draw too many conclusions. I mean, I'm obviously conscious of both the tremendous progress that's been made in Christchurch in recent years, but also the frustration held by some contemporaries. On Thursday, I think it was of last week, I went around a number of the different agencies in Christchurch firsthand just to get a bit of a sense of what they were thinking. So I went to EQC, obviously saw members of the council and others, went out to Fletcher's hub, and just generally sort of tried to take the temperature of what's happening in Christchurch. What is clear is that consenting is one of the major issues. If we can't speed up the consenting, we can't speed up the rebuild. The government cannot afford for the rebuild to go off the rails, and in effect anyway, the loss of accreditation is a decision that's been made by the independent agency, IANZ.
Is proposal in the rebuild?
No, I think overall, actually, with the right solution, will speed up the rebuild.
But if they
can't give consent, surely that's going to slow things down.
They can give consents. I think there's a technical issue about whether they're accredited to consents, but anyway, there are some other issues that might flow from that. All of that work is currently being reviewed by ENBI, and what the government's aim on Wednesday is to go to the council to discuss the issue, but hopefully to come up with some solutions and a way forward.
But if they give consents when they're not accredited, wouldn't that raise liability issues?
Could do. I can't rule that out. And that's one of the reasons why we need to find a way through this. And there are, I think, ways through it, but they're ways that should be discussed with the council first.
Are there other councils that could lose their accreditation because their consent is too slow?
Well, as I said, this issue is unprecedented. We can't find any other example either where this is likely to happen or has happened in the past.
Do you think that allowed some buildings with dodgy standards to be built?
I don't think that's the issue, as I understand it. The advice I've had, it's not about the individual consents that they've granted. It's about the overall processes and, I think, the speed of granting consents.
What were people telling you last week were the sorts of problems with those consents applied at the last week?
Well, I think there are issues. Firstly, there's frustration about the consent, because obviously you've got lots of developers who can see enormous pent-up demand and lots of buyers who want to just get on with their lives. Cash has been released as a result of the red zone purchases by the government, and there's pressure actually on house prices and on rents in Christchurch. So to alleviate that, more properties need to be built. That's the first issue. Secondly, I think there are lots of contractors willing to be engaged in the Christchurch rebuild, but for that to work, for them to invest and stay interested in the market, they need to see a pipeline of work. So that's one of the big issues from our perspective. So that's where we're also going. Third thing I think that really came through was really about EQC. And the feeling from the operators working at EQC is that the big frustration comes that their system currently doesn't allow them to tell a claimant exactly when their home will be repaired, with any degree of granularity at all. So that's deeply frustrating for people not knowing whether their home will be repaired in 6 months, 12 months or 18 months. They are making great progress. There's about 80,000 homes in that category. We marked on Thursday the 40,000th home had been repaired, and it's likely the next 40,000 will be repaired much quicker. But trying to get good information for claimants is a big part of solving frustrations for contemporaries.
When the government put the extra resources in for Moby, did you think that was going to solve the problem, or at least give yourself some breathing space with IANZ?
I don't think we were completely sure. I mean, I don't think we'd have advice that would necessarily go to this step, but I think everyone understood that was a high possibility.
And at the same time that you made that move, Mayor Parker was giving everybody assurances that the steps were in place and that everyone was over-egging this and it wasn't the crisis everyone was painting it as. In retrospect, was he right?
I don't think so. If you look at what's happened next, I mean, IANZ, I don't think, have taken this step lightly, and certainly they're independent, so they haven't taken it driven off any government actions, but they've taken it because of real concern that the process is going too slow.
Is one of the options that the government puts in place a new structure that essentially the same people are doing the same work?
I don't want to speculate really on how that might look. I mean, obviously there are lots of people tied up in consenting in Christchurch and who work for the council, and I'm sure they're good people with lots of skills. So we can't see an exodus of that talent. I think it's the flow, the overall managing of that flow, and how we can build better and bigger capacity. That's what we'll be wanting to talk to the council about.
But you don't have another battalion of dissenters waiting to go in there. Work.
No, but there are always options available to the government. I think that's one of the big advantages of central government, is it has a breadth and depth across the country, as opposed to Christchurch, which is, you know, limited to its local geographic area.
Did they have to get to this crisis before the government moved? I mean, you couldn't see this. You knew this was coming. The deadline had been put in place for this week. Why are you waiting until next Wednesday to move?
Well, I think in fairness, it takes a bit of time to work its way through that. There's a process. I mean, that, as we now know, I mean, the original letter from IANZ was sent some 2 weeks before it was publicly announced that there was actually an issue, to give the council time to at least absorb the issues. That didn't actually pass up the food chain, which of itself speaks of, you know, some of the issues that are there. You know, the rest of it is really just a process that we're not controlling, but are nevertheless ultimately part of.
Can we ask you about the Owen Glen issue as well? Government funds go into that White Ribbon campaign.
Yep.
Are you comfortable with his association with that, given these revelations?
Well, I accept him at his word. I mean, if he has signed a number of declarations to say that he has never been involved in any violent activity. He, in the end, they are slightly self-governing declarations. People have to feel comfortable that they've said what is truthfully and honestly correct. That is his position as he states it.
You're also an ambassador.
Yep.
Do you feel comfortable standing side by side with him in this campaign?
Well, I accept him at his word. I've got no reason to disprove that. And, you know, I don't have any other information other than literally picking up the Sunday Star Times and reading the story.
How much confidence do you have in his anti-child abuse campaign that he's funded?
Well, in the end, you know, it's for him to spend his money as he sees fit. You know, I've been a bit of the view that I'd like to see more money actually physically spent on the ground, because I think actually a lot of research has been done over the years, but that's the nature of philanthropists. They're free to spend their money as they see fit. And I can't say that every solution that's out there has been thought of, so of course some good work could be done. But for my money's worth, more stuff on the ground is a little more important.
Would you take that report seriously?
We'd always read it and look at it, and this is a very serious issue. I think that's why I attracted a number of very high-profile people who are prepared to serve on it. I mean, what is clear is that there's a lot of friction now and it's not going well. So see where it goes from here.
Also on housing, last week the Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank seem to rule out exemptions for spend limits on first home buyer loans. What's your view, and do you think there is a way through there?
Well, I mean, firstly, what I'd say is that you know, the government actually supports the view that the Reserve Bank has tools available to it outside of just raising interest rates, because just raising interest rates means that every part of the country, both businesses and the private individuals, pay for those higher interest rates. So I think having more tools in the toolbox is a good thing. I mean, my views on the plight of first home buyers and wanting to make sure that they can stay in the game of being able to buy a home are well documented. Government, I'm sure, in the fullness of time, will be part of the consultation process that the Reserve Bank is going through, and I for one, will certainly be making my views clear. But on the other side of the coin, in the end, the Governor has independence when it comes to these matters.
Are you concerned that David Henry accessed Peter Dunsey's house without permission?
Well, I don't think it's right to say that he actually accessed his emails. He accessed information as was actually prescribed in the inquiry, and that's really around metadata and other information around, you know, what his movements around the building and the likes. So, I mean, my view, you know, kind of on these things, especially, you know, I've noticed the Greens' statement. They're free to go to the Ombudsman if they want to. Not, frankly, sure it'll take them very far. Secondly, You know, I have, as I've publicly said before, I have great sympathy to the issue when it comes to journalists, both in terms of access to any of their information, whether it be emails or whether it be their movements around the building. I have very limited sympathy, if any at all, for a minister or former minister. And the reason for that is, A, when you're a minister, you swear an oath of allegiance. And that oath basically says that you will treat information confidentially. By definition, if you have nothing to worry about, then access to metadata as part of a proper and full inquiry should be of no concern to anyone. So when it comes to the movements of Andrea Vance or access to any of that information, I would be opposed to that. I might add that that's a matter for Mr. Henry, but I would be opposed to that. When it comes to a minister, my office made it very clear I expected people to comply. When people swore the oath of allegiance, they understood exactly what was expected of them, and the terms of conditions spelled out absolutely in plain English what was going to happen and what information was going to be looked at, and that included email traffic.
Your office has sought that information on three occasions. Yep. What was that for? Was that because of concern about a minister? Or
there was also in relation to potential leaks of information or other concerns we had, and it was solely related to staff members, and we have the legal right to do that.
You're confident you have the legal right, or David Henry has the legal right to look at editors?
Well, I haven't received any advice on the matter, but in terms of our reading of the law, yes, he has the legal right to do what he did.
Peter Dunn seems to draw the distinction between emails as a private individual or an MP as distinct as a minister. You don't draw that distinction for whatever he is.
Well, I accept that the email traffic that took place between him and Ms. Vance didn't take place as a minister. Because he's quite free to act and does and did on that occasion wear many hats. I accept that completely. But he was also a minister, one of about 30 people that got a copy of this report. A third of all of the reports went to ministers. It was clear from the inquiry we established that information would be sought and looked at. And I think given the role the minister has, the limited information, and the swearing of the oath of allegiance, actually it's quite appropriate to get metadata or other information. It's not appropriate to go straight into those emails, and my understanding is Mr. Henry never has.
One of those ministers didn't return his or her report. Did you make any further inquiries to satisfy yourself that they did actually shred it and they haven't done anything with their report?
I haven't, because I haven't really involved myself in the report other than receiving it and then following up with Mr. Henry. But my understanding from reading of Mr. Henry's report is he's quite comfortable. He's closed off all of the loose ends that he could, with the exception of his inability to take questioning further with Mr. Dunn.
On the Intelligence and Security Committee this week, yep. Will you be chairing on both Tuesday and Wednesday?
Yeah, I'll certainly be chairing. Well, that's my expectation, subject to any changes in my diary, but my expectations is Tuesday and Wednesday I will be chairing, if not for all of it, certainly for part of it. I won't be there Friday.
Will you be chairing for pin.com's submission?
That's my expectation, yes.
How do you feel about that?
More than happy to do so.
And do you have an open mind about listening to submissions and sort of adopting changes?
Yes, I mean, look, the intention here is to draft new legislation that supports the work that the GCSB does to ensure that it's crystal clear in law that what they do is lawful and to strengthen the oversight. You know, like all of my experience, which is some time ago now, sitting on the equivalent of a select committee as this is, more often than not that the select committee does come up through the submission process with good recommendations that are adopted. I see no reason why we wouldn't adopt recommendations that come through this process if they're sound.
But a number of the submissions that we've seen so far seem to be worried about making activity lawful, but you are happy to make lawful, but none of the submitters obviously are opposed to making
law. Yeah, well, there will always be people who have a philosophical difference of opinion about whether the GCSB can act as an agent for other New Zealand agencies. I believe that they can. It's certainly true that they have for a very long period of time, and the view was that was lawful. It's also the view of a number of legal teams that it remains lawful. But as we've said, and as Rebecca Kittredge's report said, there are difficulties of interpretation. And so at the end of the day, the government's view is we can't continue along that path. That's why we stopped the bulk of that assistance work and why we're now looking to clarify the law.
Have you made any progress convincing Peter Dunn of that view?
I personally haven't spoken to him, but I know that there's discussion that's ongoing. He's got a number of issues he's wanted to raise. As you would expect, you know, any member of parliament that, you know, is doing their job as he is, and we'll be happy to have those discussions with him, as we will, I'm sure, in the fullness of time with New Zealand First.
Mr Naser is about 80 years old.
Yep.
Do you think that is a bit too old for someone who should be providing oversight of intelligence agencies?
Not necessarily. I mean, I, at the end of the day, you know, some people are that vintage and they're quite capable of doing the job and for a lot longer, and others would not be fit to do that at that age. It depends on the individual. I think Mr Naser has done a good job, but I think the reality is that the reach of that office needs to be broadened, and the depth and capability needs to be broadened, and that's what we're doing. So at the end of the day, to me, that makes sense.
Was there any question of him reapplying for the job?
He didn't want to reapply.
Well, you know, he gave the big tip to 88 cases of potential unlawful spying that everyone else said was, you know, ambiguous at least. I mean, did that concern you?
Well, I don't think that's actually the right characterisation. I mean, he's not on his own, but he is, at this point, the sole arbiter of whether they were lawful or not, and he said that they are. I mean, that is the statutory person who has the responsibility to make that determination. He was appointed by Helen Clark, and he's served with a long and very significant career. I take it he understands the law.
Would you run those decisions past the incoming inspector general?
No, it wouldn't be my intention to do so. I mean, at the end of the day...
isn't that the point of Audrey's question, really, that he seems to have done this and then gone?
Well, I think in fairness to Mr Naser, he was always going. I mean, that point was raised. He'd had two terms. He'd been there since 2004. In fact, he stayed a little longer because we've been finding a new person. So there was no bias or particular reason for him to give anything other than the ruling he gave. It's what he genuinely believes.
Wouldn't it have been better to let it hang over until the new man came in and had a look at it?
I don't think so, because, I mean, we needed to deal with those issues and move on.
On the infrastructure announcement on Friday, do you think government borrowing should be part of the funding mix to pay for that infrastructure?
It may be. I mean, it'll depend on what happens at the time. Some of these projects are over a long period of time, but I think there'll be a mix of ways that we will pay for that. And obviously, it may come out of government surpluses into the future. Certainly, proceeds from the mixed ownership model. You know, certainly, the National Land Transport Fund and basically the taxes that motorists pay, and ultimately, you know, I do think there's a role for public-private partnerships. So there's a range of options here.
Do you think though that the debt to GDP should stay below that 20% target that you set?
Well, 20 is the 2020 aim, is up to 20%. All the advice I've seen from Treasury is they're confident we're going to meet that number. And actually, just looking at some of their projections, it sits around that level, a little below, actually, over quite a long period of time. Now, you know, once you start getting into the forecasts of sort of, you know, 10, 15, 20 years in the future, you're making some very big assumptions, not the least of being who might be in government and what their spending profile might look like.
Are you too reliant on the future of Eastern Fund, given that the power's struggling a wee bit and you've got Meridian to sell?
Well, MRP is irrelevant to that process now, because effectively the government's got its fund from MRP. Well, I mean, I think the program's still in good heart, and I'm very confident it'll go ahead.
Just on the GCSB, has the revelations by Snowden done anything to affect the Five Eyes relationship?
Well, I don't talk about our relationship with our partners.
Peter Sharpton appears to be softening his stance towards a recognition with the Mana Party. Is there bad for the stability of the government?
No, I don't think in terms of the stability of the government, I'd be amazed if they had any impact on the confidence and supply motion that we've got with the Māori Party. Look, in the end, every political party needs to work out where they think its future rests and where it's going to earn the most number of votes going into election 2014. In the end, you know, I don't control the Maori Party any more than I control any other political party in Parliament other than National. So in the end, they'll do what they think is right. We'll see how it goes.
If they do cozy up with Mana, does that take away a coalition?
Not necessarily. I think in the case of Mr. Harawira, I can't see him wanting to come with us. But then on the other side of the coin, he was desperate to be a minister back in 2008. I can't see us working with him, though, but we'll see.
Prime Minister, the Tourism Growth Partnership, given the sort of rhetoric there around increasing the amount of big spending tourists there, do you see potential? Do you think the MB will be looking for projects with synergies with the International Convention Centre?
Don't forget there's convention centre money, so that's a completely separate part. I think it's $20 million put aside. This is a $28 million co-investment fund. If you're asking the question, is it possible that Sky City could put together a proposal and look to co-invest with the government, the answer is yes, they could, but those decisions are made by an independent panel, just in the same way that Air New Zealand could, or China Southern could, or Auckland Airports could, or Destination Queenstown could. And in the end, that independent panel will have to decide which of the applications have the most merit and are likely to bring the most high-value tourists in New Zealand.
Given you would have had, as Tourism Minister, some hand at formulating this idea, do you see that as an area of potential? For these projects, synergies with
international. No, I mean, actually, I'd see it more likely being the $20 million we've allocated for convention funding, or, you know, for promotion of conventions. I mean, the government's plan around national conventions is transparent for everyone to see. I mean, it's build infrastructure that can support those conventions being held and promote them in New Zealand. There's nothing sinister about it. It's actually a great thing for New Zealand. We can do it.
Sunday recently reported on leaked documents from the Ministry of Social Development indicating that people who are on the mental illness benefit would be moved off it into work by private employers. Do you have any comments?
Don't recall the article, so I wouldn't want to guess on that. I mean, government's been going through its welfare reforms, and as part of that there'll be increasing work testing requirements. But for those who were previously on the invalid's benefit, which is probably the category that someone's sitting in if they have a mental health illness, they are the least likely to be work tested. And anyway, the person would actually physically have to get a job and prove they could hold that job down. Unless they can actually do that, they won't be moving off the benefit. So I didn't see the article, so I can't comment on the specifics of it.
Just going back to Christchurch, given the scale of the disaster there and the challenge facing the council, in hindsight, shouldn't it have been obvious sort of a long time ago that the council was going to run into trouble with its consenting processes? Just on a capability.
No, I don't think that's right. There are always arguments with these issues, and they come where the demarcation line is. If the government, you know, arguably gets incredibly heavy-handed and steps in and takes over all of the processes, then lots of people will cry foul and say that the government's overstepping the mark and overreaching. On the other side of the coin, what we can do is what we have done, provide as much certainty and as much support as we can. The consenting function is fundamentally the core business of the council, and that's our preference for where it stays. But we don't control and didn't control the loss of its accreditation by IANZ.
The government's been quite defensive of EQC's delays and argued the scale of this. So couldn't the council be legitimately making the same defence?
Well, the council was free to make any claims it wanted to IANZ. That's why the IANZ wrote to the council to indicate that they had real issues, and it was for the council to respond.
So what's Sarah's role in all this?
Nothing in terms of the current accreditation of resource consents. That's solely a matter for the council.
Couldn't Sarah have intervened earlier to pop the council up, hold its hand or something?
Well, I think it comes down to whether the council would have wanted them to do that, and you'd have to go and check with Gerry Brownlee, but to the best of my knowledge, I can't recall them coming to the government asking for support that was turned down.
Do you think Labor should be happy with its majority win in the Hikarau Rāwhiti by-election?
Not really, but a win's a win, I suppose. I mean, look, at the end of the day, It's hard to claim it's a resounding success when you just squeak over the line in a seat you've always held.
In regards to KiwiSaver and the talk of the restriction on the high LVR ratio loans, would it be possible, has it been looked at as an option to, as a KiwiSaver first home buyer guidelines, could that be used to shield those first home buyers from any lending restrictions?
It hasn't been looked at because we are actually going through the process at some point of consultation with Reserve Bank is consulting, and we'll be one of the parties that they consult with. But by definition, people releasing funds from their KiwiSaver account builds their equity and therefore, you know, hopefully helps improve the position when it comes to how much they need to borrow from the bank. So by definition, you know, that the first home buyers scheme that sits within part of KiwiSaver helps take the pressure off first home owners.
There's been quite big withdrawals from KiwiSaver and also some government subsidies. Do you think that's played a role in boosting house prices in the last year?
Well, overly. I think it's important to remember that the scheme, you know, you have to be in the scheme for a period of time until you could actually withdraw your money. And so in reality, we're just hitting the cycle of people that are eligible to take out their money. I think a better assessment of it would be a lot of people went into KiwiSaver with the intention of getting the obvious benefits which were embedded in part of that process to allow them to buy their first home. I think they'll go back over time and continue to save for their own nest egg. In a way, you'd say that part of the scheme's working.
Couldn't you say this part of government policy is working against what the Reserve Bank is trying to do, which is slow down some of that high LVR lending growth?
Well, again, I go back to the point of if by definition you are saving more in your KiwiSaver and the government puts in a contribution, which it does, and those funds are released, they are by definition equity and they lower the LVR requirement that any borrower has. If you add on top of that your own savings, actually they assist the process, they don't hurt the process.
Are you concerned that it's being done at the expense of perhaps saving for your retirement, and your people are, you know, taking out these loans and then they're heavily indebted, so they no longer contribute to KiwiSaver by reducing the contributions? Is it concerned that, you know, they're jumping into a better house than they're sort of growing perhaps retirement savings?
Well, I'd have to go and refresh myself on the exact conditions under which they can take a contributions holiday. They certainly can, and they can roll that over for a period of time. But I think there is a natural sort of cycle that most people go through, and that earlier on in the piece involves them often buying a home, and then as the years go by, focusing a little more heavily on their retirement and building up that nest egg. So the sequential order is about right to me, and I'm not overly concerned by that. I mean, the bigger issue, I think, is actually it's a good thing that people are in KiwiSaver because, A, it gives them that optionality around first-time buyers, but I think the other issue there is it does allow them to, you know, focus on ultimately building alternative savings away from New Zealand Super for their retirement. Because what we know is, you know, people are going to live a lot longer. They're going to be able to do more in their retirement, and therefore, by definition, they'll need more disposable income.
Is there an option you can do it perhaps outside of KiwiSaver, like help queues into their first homes and buy another in yourself, perhaps not at the expense of...
Technically, of course, you can. That's true of the way the Australians did it in their first home buyers grant scheme. I mean, KiwiSaver is just a kind of a form of that in a way, less generous and all the rest of it, but fundamentally it's the same kind of principle. But I think the vehicle seems to be quite a good vehicle for encouraging people to go to save for their first home.
Apropos of a
digital
question, if you
were
to fall under a bus tomorrow, what do you think would be the best replacement for you?
Someone with a sense of humour.
We asked the same thing of Helen Clark once.
What did she say?
Trevor Mallow.
Ah, I thought she would have said John Key. Look, I don't know. In the end, we've got a very talented caucus, and if I name one of them, the other 58 will 57 by definition. If I take myself out, will be bitter and twisted. So if I'm under a bus, been nice knowing you all, and I'll leave it to them to sort out what happens next.
What about your top three?
Top three, well, no. Leave it. We'll leave it for others.
So, Prime Minister,
yeah.
Have you been in touch with the new Australian Prime Minister at all, and do you have a view on the change there?
Well, I've certainly been in touch. I spoke to Kevin Rudd last Thursday night, and I spoke to Julia Gillard on Sunday. It's not for me to determine, you know, who's the right leader of the Labor Party in Australia or the right Prime Minister for Australia. That's for Australians, but I wish Kevin Rudd the best. Indicated that I thought the relationship, bilateral relationship, was in great heart. Look forward to working with him over the months ahead. and basically in terms of Julie Gillard, just reiterate that I thought she had, you know, done sterling work in terms of building a relationship with New Zealand. I'd enjoyed working with her, that we'd built up a personal relationship with her and Tim, and invited them to come to New Zealand if they wanted to in a private capacity in the future.
What did Rod say in the team?
So he was looking forward to it, had a lot of work to do, thought the Labour Party was now competitive in Australia, and elections would be coming up.
How did he characterise the relationship?
He thought it was a good heart. I mean, he had no particular reason not to believe that. I mean, look, at the end of the day, it was obviously a pretty brief discussion because he had lots of things to deal with on Thursday, but you know, I think he's very knowledgeable about the relationship. He was over here when the earthquakes, after the earthquakes at one point, as Foreign Minister. So,
did you issue the invitation to Julia and Tim? Is John Key, your Prime Minister?
John Key, actually. Tell them they're welcome to come and stay. Okay, thanks very much.